Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good afternoon. First, I'd like to thank the Charles M. and Martha Hitchcock Foundation and the Hitchcock family for making it possible for us today to hear from Dr. Sylvia Earle. I met with Sylvia a few minutes ago, and I asked what she'd like me to do to introduce her. And she said, "Oh, just say, here's Sylvia." If you were here yesterday to hear Dr. Earle's talk, you heard Professor Lester describe her long list of accomplishments and honors. Most of these are also listed in the program, and I will not attempt to enumerate them all. Here's the Black Lightning version. Dr. Sylvia Earle is an oceanographer, explorer, author, lecturer, and experienced field research scientist. She is the president of Sea Alliance, a nonprofit whose mission is to create awareness of the ocean's importance to life, explore global waters, and inspire conservation action. In 1992, Dr. Earle founded Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, which pioneered technologies for ocean scientific research and exploration. Early in her career, she led the first team of women aquanauts during the Tektite project. And among her several diving records, she was the first person to dive solo to a depth of 1,250 feet without being connected to a support vessel. Dr. Earle is an accomplished scholar who earned her undergraduate degree from Florida State University and her master's and PhD from Duke. She's authored more than 180 publications, many of them documenting the aquatic plant life of the Gulf of Mexico. Dr. Earle was the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's chief scientist from 1990 and 1992, and is currently an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. It's this last position that characterizes Dr. Earle. She is, and foremost, an explorer. She's had more than 100 expeditions worldwide, and while she's quick to tell us that less than 5% of the Earth's oceans have been explored, I can find hardly a stretch of ocean anywhere on the planet that she hasn't visited. Whether it was when she was first learning to dive in the 50s in Florida, or on the underwater missions living and working on Tektite and Aquarius, she got to live up close and personal and very deep with a diversity of life that is found in our oceans. She's logged over 7,000 hours underwater in connection with this research. Fortunately for us, she has and continues to take us along on her exploratory journeys, using them to inspire and energize all generations, but most importantly, the young, with her passion for conservation of the blue planet and a love for science. Today, Dr. Sylvia Earle will talk to us about exploring the deep frontier. Here's Sylvia.
I think that's the best introduction I've ever had. So thank you, and thanks for coming in on this beautiful afternoon to take a few dives into the deep. I hope if you haven't already mastered the fine art of slipping on fins and face mask, and scuba tank is nice, rebreathers are even nicer. The submarine will also do, but whatever it takes, don't miss the chance during this little time that you have on the blue speck in the universe that we call Earth, should be called ocean, to explore it yourself. If I could do just one thing, it would be to inspire everybody to go see for themselves what's out there in the ocean. The biggest problem with the ocean isn't what we're putting into it, although that's a big problem. It isn't what we're taking out of it. That's a big problem, too. But far and away, the biggest problem is the complacency that comes with not knowing, with ignorance, with just being unaware of the nature of the ocean, how important it is to everybody with every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, that yes, there is concern growing about taking care of whales, and yes, there is awareness about the melting of the polar ice and just the loss of so much so fast. But there is still this impression that I have experienced most of my life, that the ocean is so big, so vast, so resilient, that there isn't much we can do to hurt the ocean, to harm the ocean. And if there is pollution, or if we have lost a few species here or there, or if coral reefs go bye-bye forever, so what? Well, if you get out there and see for yourself, the answer to that question comes into focus pretty clearly, that on our watch, during our time, decisions will be made or not made that will have a profound impact on everything that follows. We live in a time that will determine the fate of whales, the fate of coral reefs, the fate ultimately, perhaps, of our species, ourselves, based on the awareness that it matters to take care of the living world, the wet world, to take care of the ocean, because that's where most of the action actually is. Knowing that is within everyone's grasp today, but not everyone takes advantage of the opportunity that is all around us to gain that insight, to gain that knowledge, and to allow that to shape the decisions that we make every day, that all stack together, make the world flow in the direction that it will go. So I appeal to you, go get wet. My idea that I hope everybody ultimately will take to heart for an education program that is absolutely vital for kids coming along. Yeah, I mean, there's this No Child Left Behind, and there's the other take on that No Child Left Indoors. I think no child should be left dry. And that means all of you, too. Because everybody, it doesn't matter how many decades you've been around, there's a child in there waiting to discover the undiscovered or to see for the first time yourself. I get asked sometimes, how did you get to be an explorer? How did you get to be a scientist? And I say to kids, it's really easy. You start out like you, as a kid, and you do what kids do. You ask questions. You, who, what, why, where, when, how. And you don't stop. And you maintain that same three-year-old sense of wonder over everything you look at, and it's fantastic. Whether it's a ladybug or a mushroom or the sun coming up in the morning and disappearing over the horizon at night, it's that sense of wonder and appreciating that we're alive during this extraordinary part of history, making history. If you want to choose a time, choose now and never lose that curiosity that comes naturally when you're born. And somehow people have a way of letting it get inundated with everyday life. So that's how you get to be a scientist. You don't let that happen. Or to be an explorer, you just continue doing what three-year-olds do. You just never quite grow up. I know there's some scientists out there, some would-be scientists. I think there's a kid lurking there. Doesn't matter what you call yourself these days. All of us have maybe a heightened responsibility to get to know this world and understand how fast it's changing and do what we can to secure an enduring future, not just for the rest of our lives, but because of the tipping points that are just right there on the edge, with CO2 in the atmosphere, acidification of the ocean, the loss of many creatures on the land and in the sea, whole ecosystems at risk. But most of all, we're at risk if you really get right down to what matters. So I didn't know about these things when I started diving back in the 1950s. All I knew is that I love diving. I loved science that I wanted to be. I didn't know what to call it when I was 5 years old, but I did know I had to do something with critters. And later I understood that's biology. That's science. And so I made the choices along the way, not because I was consciously trying to get anywhere in particular, but because I did what I had the latitude with parents who encouraged this and with teachers who didn't discourage it so much along the way to follow my heart. And that's what I also advise to kids coming along. Do what you really love. If it's music, fine. But let the natural world be a part of your life as well. You want to go into politics? Great. But never lose sight of the fact that you are a part of the living world, and it's your job, in part, to take care of the system that takes care of you. It should be as vital as learning your letters and your numbers as a kid. You've got to take care of the natural world that takes care of us. And if everybody did it, we might not even need national parks to hold the line against the loss of diversity or to protect watersheds. We might not have to do what I find myself now running flat out to try to achieve, which is protected areas in the sea, to at least save something of what remains of that heritage that goes back to the beginning of Earth, that we have a chance to squander the assets in such a short time or to keep them and give some hope that they'll be around giving us life far into the future. So, today I've just brought a few video clips that I want to share with you to help tell the story of my personal story in part, but exploring the deep frontier. It's the ocean. It's most of the world. So how are you going to cram exploring most of the world into a few minutes? Well, this is not going to be perfect, but it's going to be a glimpse of some of the things that maybe hit on the issues that right now, at this critical point in time, can make a difference if we really pay attention and use our collective, our individual, and our collective powers to ultimately address peeling back the unknown, gaining the knowledge that we need, getting it into the minds and hearts of as many people as we possibly can to shape the way forward through policies, through everyday decisions, through whatever it takes to try to leave this planet at least as good as we found it, at least as good. Maybe we can actually turn things toward making it better. So, yesterday I began with a little clip, thanks to Google, that takes you around the world in a few seconds to look at some of the places that have been explored, that need to be explored. So I'm going to do it again, but with another series of places. So watch this. Mwaha. There we go. You made the world turn. And you can do this too, of course. That's what's so cool about being alive right now. Couldn't do this when I was a kid. Couldn't do it 5 years ago. To go explore places such as here, the Gulf of Mexico, the Flower Garden Banks, a little speck in the Gulf that is protected out of all that mass of water, or to fly over eastward from there. Look at the lemon sharks as they gather off the Bahamas. Or let's fly out to the Patagonian Shelf, a place that currently is at risk from squid fishing, among other things. The Patagonian Shelf is one of the richest, most productive parts of the ocean. It's where orcas come ashore to munch on elephant seal pups. It's a place that is known mostly from the shoreward basis or from fishing fleets, but little is known in terms of scientific exploration. The Coral Sea. Right now, the Australian government is considering establishing right adjacent to the Great Barrier Reef what could be the biggest marine protected area in the ocean so far. if they make the decision in that direction. And there's this big Barry grouper. I mean, it's a big Napoleon wrasse that if you go to Australia, you'll be able to, or go to Google, you can hear with an Australian accent Barry, the Napoleon wrasse, telling you why it really matters to save the coral sea. But this image of the Trieste, the submersible that once and nevermore took people to the deepest part of the sea in 1960. 51 years ago. Oh, once people went to the deepest place in the sea, 7 miles down. Nobody has been back since. Well, vicariously, actually, Japan had a deep diving ROV, Kaiko, that several times went down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench and came back, but it was lost in a storm several years ago. Woods Hole has come up with a wonderful piece of equipment, Nereus, that has made 9 trips to the deepest part of the ocean and brought back confirmation of what Jacques Picard and Don Walsh saw with their own eyes 51 years ago, that there's life down there. There's life throughout the water column from the surface to the greatest depths, even at the bottom, where the pressure is 16,000 pounds per square inch. Amazing. How could we have waited so long to go back? And we still can't do it, although Jim Cameron and Richard Branson and teams of engineers that they are paying for privately are working to try to overcome the issues to go to full ocean depth. And as I did point out during my remarks yesterday, India is engaged in now the development of a deep diving sub, not to go to full ocean depth, but to go to 6,000 meters, like China going to 7,000 meters. France has a 6,000 meter submersible. Russia has 3, United States has 0. We've got to fix this, I think. It isn't just like a race to the bottom, as some would portray the idea, but rather, it's a race against time to try to understand the ocean from the inside out. We now live in a time of profound ignorance of the nature of the ocean. Although we've learned more in the last half century than during all preceding history about the ocean, less than 5% has really been seen, let alone explored, let alone really mapped, with the same degree of accuracy that we have for the moon, Mars, Jupiter. What are we thinking? What are we thinking? Why are we ignoring the ocean? Except as a source of things to take out or a place to put things that we don't want close to where we are. Why is it taking us so long to respect the ocean for what it gives us every day? Life. I want to take you to a place that I really love for a lot of reasons, but one of the special ones is that this is where the first glimpse of what it was like to see the ocean from the inside out, as much as half a mile beneath the surface. It's still the skin of the ocean. But this goes back to the 1930s when William Beebe and engineer Otis Barton, in the little submersible called the Bathysphere, designed by Otis Barton, these two guys crammed inside this steel ball on the end of a cable, conditions that today OSHA would definitely not approve. Lloyd's would definitely not have insured this. ABS, not certified. No, not at all. But they did it. And let me show in this little glimpse of the waters off Bermuda around the Sargasso Sea in a recreation, and partly, this is real, part of it's recreated by the National Geographic. You can find this on, ta-da, Google Earth, Google Ocean. If you go to Bermuda and look for the little blue dot that you can touch and open up this little sequence. Intensely blue, the waters around Bermuda are warmed by the Gulf Stream, one of the world's largest and swiftest ocean currents. Humpback whales pass through these waters each year, migrating from polar feeding grounds. These waters are also known to legions of luminous deep-sea creatures and intrepid undersea explorers. In the 1930s, zoologist William Beebe and engineer Otis Barton descended 1,000 meters into the depths around Bermuda for a first view of life in a place the sunlight never reaches. Beebe compared what he saw to naked space itself, out far beyond atmosphere, between the stars, where the blackness of space, the shining planets, comets, suns, and stars must really be closely akin to the world of life as it appears to the eyes of an old human being in the open ocean, 1/2 mile down. For Beebe and Barton, the comets, suns, and stars were living creatures reflecting rainbows of iridescence, or flashing, sparkling, and glowing with their own living light. Fireflies and glowworms are famous light makers on the land, but in the deep sea, about 90% of the creatures, jellies, fish, bacteria, shrimp, squids, and many others, have some form of bioluminescence to signal one another. Scientists say these bursts of starry light may be the most common form of communication on the planet. In the open sea, jellies are also among the most abundant forms of life. The Gulf Stream current can carry these oddly beautiful drifters along at about 160 kilometers a day. Buffered by the Gulf Stream is a magically quiet, gently rotating mass of sargassum weed that expands over more than 5 million square kilometers of open waters. Isolated by walls of fast-moving currents between Bermuda and Puerto Rico, the Sargasso Sea holds a liquid jungle of creatures which have evolved over the ages to exist in floating forests of golden-brown sargassum. Within its leafy, sunlit masses are camouflaged such creatures as loggerhead turtles, filefish, sea hares, and the speckled brown sargasso crab. For scientists, it's a living laboratory, strategically located in the open sea. For creatures that live in the undersea caves, among the reefs, and in the great depths below, Bermuda is simply home. In the end, I suppose you could say that the ocean is home for all of us. That is, that we're all, one way or the other, we're sea creatures. Every bit as much as that little seahorse or the other creatures that we think of as distinctly oceanic. But imagine us without the ocean. It's unthinkable. I mean, we are as hooked in, as dependent on the existence of the ocean as any coral reef or sargassum mat community. It's something that, again, we miss that in our education. And some people never acquire it. I feel especially blessed to have been soaked in the ocean long enough to kind of get it, that this is it. Earth is blue. We have to take care of it. It's up to us. A few years ago, I began to work with some of my fellow explorers at the Explorers Club in New York, dreaming of going to one of those great places that might highlight the condition of the world today, and that is, let's go to the real North Pole. I mean, of course people have been to the North Pole. Perry went there in 1909. Didn't he? Yes, he did. But he didn't get to the real North Pole because the real North Pole is way below the ice. The Arctic Ocean harbors the North Pole. So, talking with Anatoly Sagalovich, who designed the Mir subs, with Don Walsh, who was the pilot of the Trieste, working with Fred McLaren, who was the pilot or the captain of the Queenfish, the nuclear submarine that goes under the Arctic ice, or did back in the 1960s, to record the thickness of the ice and the nature of the configuration of the seafloor below. So we had these big ideas, but first one thing and then another thing and then something else happened to cause the great green dreams and screams and schemes to go awry. And then came August of 2007. I had a message on my cell phone. It was from Anatoly Sagalovich, and it went something like this. Sylvia, this is Anatoly Sagalovich. I'm calling you from the North Pole. I have just come back from diving 4,200 meters beneath the ice. And then there was a pause, and I could hear the clinking of glasses. I'm sure it was vodka in the background, lots of hooping and hollering. We missed you. This was a great achievement for science. And then more laughing and clinking and celebration in the background. And then the killer comment, but it was our achievement. This is Russia establishing with a titanium flag in the heart of the Arctic. Just a little notice to the rest of the world that they're laying claim to much of the Arctic by going there with their mirror subs and by establishing, they hope, a sort of a precedent to help show that that they're part of the Arctic that goes out, according to the law of the sea, 200 miles, but beyond that, perhaps, an extension of the continental shelf, a natural extension they would like to demonstrate. So I'm going to show you a little clip now of going to the Arctic. Again, one of these little tours that you can see if you go to Google the ocean in Google Earth. Find the little blue dot that will take you, ocean tour, and then a series of about a dozen places like this with clips that will take you on a little expedition. And this one includes a glimpse of the mirror subs as they make their historic descent to the real North Pole. Gleaming starkly white, the frozen Arctic Ocean crowns the top of the world above 66 degrees north latitude. In the Arctic, above the ice and below, wildlife prospers in what might seem to be an inhospitable environment. But it's exactly what is required for polar bears, ring seals, and the snowy white beluga whales, the highly vocal canaries of the sea. Narwhals, the legendary unicorns of the sea, and bowheads, the great ice whales, thrive there and nowhere else on Earth. In the cold, dark waters of the Arctic, life abounds, as it has for millions of years, unknown, unseen, and still largely unexplored. Under the ice, and actually within the ice itself, life is surprisingly rich and diverse. Photosynthesizing organisms cast a green glow across the sweep of the ice. Arctic birds, fulmars, guillemots, kittiwakes, and ivory gulls survive on a diet rich in Arctic cod, while murres dive down as deep as 100 meters in search of fish and squid. Walruses look elsewhere for meals, using their great tusks to plow into the soft underwater terrain to extract clams, worms, and other tasty morsels. And deep within the heart of the Arctic, 4,200 meters down, is the North Pole, visited for the first time in August 2007 by six explorers in a pair of Russian submarines, Mir 1 and Mir 2. For hours, they observed and documented the seafloor, struggling to understand the nature of polar life far below the surface. The struggle to reach the North Pole at the Arctic surface has lured hardy explorers for centuries. Robert Perry and Matthew Henson claimed the first successful expedition in 1909. Other explorers to the Arctic Ocean have sought the fabled Northwest Passage, a direct shipping route from Europe to Asia across the polar ice. Today, global warming is melting the ice cap so fast that scientists expect the passage to become a reliable summer shipping route within a few decades. That's good news for shipping, but bad news for polar bears, Arctic seals, and the people of the Arctic, whose cultural heritage is inextricably linked to living in a realm dominated by ice and snow. Keen interest is now focused on the Arctic and its nature, particularly because of the magnified importance of the frozen northern waters in shaping global climate and weather, the circulation of ocean currents, and ultimately, the well-being of humankind. That last sentence, the well-being of humankind, is truly what it's all about in the end. And that's what's missing from much that is really the focus of attention for the ocean these days. It's where can we go to catch more fish, or where can we go to find new deposits of oil and gas, or how can we actually mine the deep sea? One of the latest and greatest causes for concern, using bulldozer-like techniques to scrape the crusts from the ocean floor to get those rare minerals, rare earths that are needed for those really important things like cell phones and computers and things that we now have become addicted to. Some really clever engineers ought to think about two things. One, how do we recover these rare materials out of recycled throwaway cell phones and computers and stuff, instead of just letting them disappear? Or come up with some alternatives. Why do we need these rare earths anyway? I know for getting them smaller and smaller, but there must be some solutions, some end runs that will enable us to avoid doing the equivalent of mountaintop removal to get the coal, seams of coal out of Virginia, West Virginia, to take big chunks of the ocean to get little handfuls of something that we value now. Somehow we need to get our priorities straight and understand the real value of the ocean should be recognized every time we take a breath, every time we take a bath, every time we take a drink of water, whatever, to link it back to why the ocean matters. I've had such a good experience here over the last few days, meeting with students, meeting with some of the faculty, the scientists, who are doing the important work of dragging information, the secrets from nature, out of whatever it is, using your talents, using your minds, using your life to try to answer some of the questions about how does the world work? Little pieces here, little pieces there, a connection between this and that, and soon you've got some greater understanding that really informs the world about why it matters and what we need to do to take care of the world that takes care of us. I'm really honored to have a chance to touch base with you, and I hope this is just really a reintroduction to some of you and an opportunity to go into some of these issues more deeply and to make this the beginning of an ongoing relationship. I'm going to go now to an image, a couple of them, that will be the basis for some comments. The Gulf of Mexico, that's where I first put a face mask and fins on. In fact, even before 1953, the year before, my brother, conspiring with the son of our next-door neighbor, borrowed our next door neighbor's copper diving helmet. He was a sponge diver. And this was in Dunedin, Florida. Tarpon Springs is just up the coast, famous for sponge diving community. It goes back to the 1930s or so. Well, we dragged this equipment. I was the kid sister who tagged along to go to the Weekiwachee River to dive in using a little gasoline-powered compressor. And just the helmet part, not the big canvas suit and not the lead-weighted shoes, so my feet kept floating up. But it was enough just to get underwater, to breathe underwater, to see fish. I thought I was there to look at the fish. I found that the fish were really fascinated with us, with me, came swimming around, and it was my introduction to breathing underwater. And the next year, armed with one of the two systems that were first brought into the country, that Harold Hum, a professor at Florida State University, made available to this class of eight little tadpoles, students in a class in marine biology, who were given a chance to try not just scuba, but also a Desco face mask with a hose going back to the surface again with a compressor, enabling us to swim around at, 50, 60 feet under the surface. It was a gift. I learned quite a lot about marine biology, but mostly I got hooked on wanting to go see for myself. And over the years, the Gulf of Mexico has been my laboratory, if you will, a place where I came to love the systems that were there, the fields of seaweed and the rocky outcrops, the coral reefs that, from down in the Tortugas all the way up to those that are offshore from the Mississippi River, the Flower Garden Banks that I first heard about by reading Skin Diver magazine. It was about 1975. I didn't know about their existence when I finished my dissertation at Duke in 1966. I thought I knew something about seaweeds in the Gulf, but I didn't know about this tongue of the Caribbean that came far into the Gulf of Mexico and not only brought tropical algae, but a whole suite of organisms, including corals. There's so much that we still have to learn about the Gulf of Mexico, about what's in the deepest place, the Sigsbee Deep off Yucatan. Since that first breath of air that I took in the Weekiwachee River and later off St. Mark's in the northern Gulf of Mexico, I've had hundreds of dives in various places, now including the Western Gulf. I spent the night in the Deep Rover, one-person sub off Veracruz, went down at sunset and came up at dawn the next morning, and all night just sitting on the reef. It was like a portable underwater laboratory. But I was, in one sense, I was by myself, all alone in this clear bubble sitting on the reef 100 feet down. In another sense, I was just in the midst of a metropolis of life, watching this great speckled moray eel come in, slither around and disappear, and 20 minutes later it'd come in from another area, just looking and seeing and then snapping up the little creatures that were attracted to my lights. It was an experience that, again, I wish all of you could share and could enjoy. And why not go out off San Clemente or off Monterey and not be content with being on the shore, being on the boat, but why not jump over the side and go down 1,000 feet where the krill live in this sparkling world of bioluminescence? It's all there for you to do. I was so excited about wanting to do this, and I never could and still haven't been able to wangle a way to get down in the Alvin. I tried about 30 variations on the theme of submarines. The Alvin still eludes me, and now it's going through a renovation and won't be back in business for at least another year. But so one of my good friends over the years has come to be astronaut, skywalking astronaut, Kathy Sullivan, who succeeded me as the chief scientist at NOAA. So we go diving. She has, as I say, her ups and downs. She's a skywalking astronaut, but she also loves submarines, and she's a dedicated diver. And I rib her sometimes about how, as an astronaut, she just had to be a really good geologist and really have a passion for flying. And, you know, somebody built the spacecraft for her. They paid her a salary. Not very much, but they did pay her a salary. They made it possible for her, encouraged her to go off in the sky. And when they came back, she, of course, was and should be recognized as a hero. Those of us who go down in the ocean, well, I wanted to go, and I, you know, got frustrated waiting to go in Alvin. So I did what most scientists are loath to do. I started a company with engineers, Deep Ocean Engineering, Deep Ocean Technology, going back to 1980, inspired after I had a chance to walk on the ocean floor in the gym suit and realize, you know, you don't have to stop at 100 feet or 500 feet. If you wrap yourself in a one-atmosphere shell, like Bruce Robeson figured this out too, using the little systems that were developed mostly for the oil and gas industry, but he borrowed them off of the shelf where they had been used by oceaneering for pipeline inspection and rig maintenance, used the WASP, and used the Deep Rover, the system that the company I started ultimately built, to do scientific exploration with scientists from mostly UC Santa Barbara, but up and down the coast, mostly from California, but not entirely, looking at what it was like in the water column off Monterey. But, you know, it just is so frustrating not to have ready access when you know engineering-wise it's possible. But, so, I started the company not knowing anything about accounting or law or the tax code or personnel issues or, you know, all the things that when you have a startup company, like making payroll, that you have to know about and think about and finally make happen. So I did my MBA the hard way by starting the company and being responsible for those things and wrangling, working with engineers to come up with a design, working with Graham Hawks, working with colleagues that we pulled in to solve the problems. Like, okay, you're in a submarine, but there's a thing that you want to get out there. You use this cranky old manipulator to go like a pair of pliers, grab a hold of it, and oh, you squish the very thing you wanted to catch and bring back. And oh, it's so frustrating. As a diver, you can be gentle, but with a submarine and a mechanical arm, it's not so easy. But why can't we use our clever minds to figure these things out? Actually, in recent times, people have begun and are succeeding in figuring them out. At Harbor Branch in Florida, with the Johnson Sea Lynx, at Imbari, certainly at Woods Hole, at Scripps with underwater vehicles that can simulate the human presence using remotely operated systems. But here we are in 2000, and this time last year it was 2010, Gulf of Mexico, where when I began diving many years ago, images such as this were rare. Since then, on the order of more than 30,000 wells have been drilled in the Gulf of Mexico, platforms established to recover the fossil fuels that are deep within the heart of the Gulf. Nothing inherently bad with doing this. In fact, I have nothing but the utmost respect for the engineering feats that are involved with designing, developing, and accomplishing what's been accomplished in the last 50 or so years to extract from the heart of the earth these amazing materials. I've had an inside look serving on the board of a company called Oryx Energy that was a little company based in Texas, but working in the Gulf of Mexico to do just that, extract oil and gas reserves out of the deep sea in the Gulf. They were pioneers in the really working in the deep sea and subsequently on the board of Dresser Industries that built much of the equipment and involved with pipelines. How do you transport oil? I mean, I really got an up-close and personal education about the skills involved in finding and then developing this, really like a space station at sea that independently can support in this, like a hotel facilities, but with engineering capabilities that rival anything that we've put into space. It's miraculous what we're able to do to find and recover and extract and market and power our civilization all over the world. I've served on the board of several other entities during the years that I have gotten this great parallel education as a biologist, as a scientist, working with engineers. I'm not an engineer, but I have immense respect for those that actually can accomplish this. I found this stunning. First of all, that we got this image, and secondly, that it took us so long to get this image after the Deepwater Horizon began spilling oil from the well that was drilled at a starting depth of a mile beneath the surface. It took a remotely operated vehicle system to go down and capture this image, and soon a whole suite of little remotely operated vehicles were brought to get images of what was down, what was happening on the deep sea floor. What was frustrating, though, is that we couldn't get a submarine with people, with scientists, with observers, with engineers, with politicians who ought to see what it's like down there, to take them down themselves and see for themselves what is it like on the ocean floor, what's happening away from where this gusher is taking place. This is about all we got to see, right on the gusher itself. What was happening 100 or 1,000 feet away, we still don't know. And when a call came out for equipment that could go there, all right, where, United States, is there, other than with the oil and gas industry, equipment available? They can go a mile beneath the ocean. It should be easy. I mean, Woods Hole does have equipment to do that. Scripps, there are few places other than just with Imbari, of course. University of Hawaii has two Pisces subs that can go to 2,000 meters. And the Alvin. Russia volunteered to bring the Mir subs, or subs, both of them were available, to go down and check it out. Let's go see what's happening in the Gulf. And somehow, it never happened. Jim Cameron convened a meeting privately in Washington of the best experts he could muster to say, okay, everybody with assets, everybody with ideas, how are we going to go out and see what's happening to stop this from going any further and to assess what's happening, to get a grip on it? He was not taken very seriously by the government or by maybe the scientific community, but it was an earnest attempt to get people together, to really put our heads together. At the time, it seemed, when it first began in April of 2010 and then on into June and on into July, that we would try almost anything to stop the flow of oil and gas from the bottom of the ocean. And one thing we didn't have the capacity to do in this country was to whip out a convenient ROV from the Coast Guard or from NOAA. They don't have an ROV at the Coast Guard or NOAA. Or a submersible in the garage with the Coast Guard or with NOAA. It just doesn't exist yet. Maybe now that we know that these things happen, we need to have the capacity to respond. And even without emergency situations like this, what about just exploring the ocean, knowing what's there in the first place? Well, as I say, I sort of got out of the traces as a scientist a bit, starting a company, first in 1980 and 1981, and then off to Washington in 1990 as the chief scientist of NOAA. But when I came back, I started another company, Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, that was a modest little entity, mostly consulting, until 1997, when my daughter, Elizabeth Taylor, and Ian Griffith, her pal, and also her husband, also the father of two of my grandchildren, took the company over. They own it and operate it. It's over in Alameda. And since then, some wonderful things have been happening, and I hope that you will accept the invitation to check it out. Go over to Alameda, meet with the engineers, inspire them with some thoughts about not only how to craft the various devices that we can use to solve the problems, to explore, to understand, and to react to catastrophes when they happen. It's a company founded with the idea of certainly making a living, but beyond that, to make a difference. Vehicles such as this, one of them made its way down to Scripps recently as a scientific tool in the box to be able to explore and understand the ocean. Right now, around the world, mostly in the oil and gas industry, there are literally hundreds of remotely operated vehicles. Some of them active, some of them have been retired, but just mostly brought into service for exploitation of the ocean. We need variations on the theme, capitalizing on this investment to explore the ocean, to understand the ocean, to figure out what's really valuable about the ocean. Not just the things that we can extract and use and sell, but the things that keep us alive, and how we need to protect those systems. And here's one of my dream machines, still on the drawing board, but taking the distillation of much that has been invested in the Johnson Sea Links, in the development of systems such as the Alvin, new batteries, new technologies for pressure hulls, new electronics, new cameras, new lights, you name it. We've come so far, so fast in the capacity to design and build access to the sea. What's holding us back? What's gotten into our heads that we have invested heavily into aviation and aerospace in the 20th century, and we're still doing it, and it's paid off handsomely? We're still neglecting the ocean, and it's costing us dearly. The magnitude of our ignorance is really costing us dearly. Well, here's another slick little machine that is not just on the drawing boards. It exists. Looks like, I don't know exactly what it looks like. I'll tell you what it is. It's a machine to go through a 22-inch borehole in the ice in Antarctica, funded by the National Science Foundation for scientists at Northern Illinois University, Ross Powell and his colleagues. They want to know what's going on beneath the shelf ice in Antarctica. We know it's disappearing. Is the melt ice flowing underneath the ice shelf? Let's go find out. Sure, let's go find out. It's a kilometer thick. How are you going to get there? Well, you bore a hole, which in itself is a big challenge. How do you do that through a kilometer of ice, 22 inches in diameter, and then send a robot down through the ice? It's a little far to send a human, at least today, maybe someday, and then swim under the ice shelf that is believed to be and has, I guess to some extent, confirmed to have some water beneath, but we don't know how deep or what the salinity is. But to go through the ice and then emerge at the bottom and then take this slim pencil-like formation, this shape, and like the Transformer toys that are all the rage today, open up with manipulators, cameras, lights, and a suite of sensors that will take measurements, take samples, and stay out there for a week or so, sending information up by a fiber optic link to the surface where scientists can shiver in a tent looking at images brought back real time, looking at data brought back real time. And with luck, they'll bring the machine back eventually and have it fold up again into this nice sleek form and make its way back up through the hole in the ice. So there are solutions. And what's lacking is imagination. And maybe, what can I call it? The guts to leap out of the box and do something while there's still time? We can all make a difference one way or the other, and everybody has power. The question is, how are we individually and collectively going to use our power at this critical point in time? We don't have a lot of time to make decisions that will have a magnified impact on the future about will there or will there not be coral reefs going forward? Will there or will there not be tuna fish going forward? Will there or will there not be rockfish here in California where some populations have been reduced down by more than 90%? This is really up to us. And why aren't we really excited about this? We have a chance that nobody before could possibly know because we didn't have the information we now have. And going forward in another 20 or 30 years, we'll miss the window, the time that is open for us. So one thing that I find encouraging is something, a glimpse that I will show, one example of why I'm encouraged. America's Cup, a sporting event that has been regarded as high-end multi-zillionaires, playboys, if you will, playing with toys, these beautiful yachts, but calling on engineering skills that are at the cutting edge of today's technology in terms of materials, computer modeling, looking at what it takes to get the last little bit of speed out of wind. And you want to win a race, of course, but how do you get there? Huge investment of funds have been committed over many years to fine-tune ships that go fast, just powered by the wind. But nothing like what is happening now, using catamarans and materials that didn't exist when America's Cup began in the 1800s and didn't exist on through most of the 20th century, and some didn't exist until right about now, being brought into focus and use. And that in itself is exciting. Imagine getting these gazillionaires to invest in the technology to show us how to harness the wind and get the maximum use out of something that is basically free and an alternate source of power. Well, actually, the Cook Islands in the South Pacific, they, along with 11 other South Pacific nations, have decided that they want to actually go back to some of their traditional ways with voyaging canoes to harness the wind, using new materials, using solar panels, using their ancient navigation, but they can also tune into GPS. Why not? It exists. To re-engage transport among the islands with canoes powered by the wind, the way they used to do over the centuries that have passed, without an ounce of oil involved. To look to using the sun and wind to power their societies. This summer, in July, actually, the leader of the Cook Islands came to San Francisco and met a group of voyaging canoes that started in New Zealand this spring, made their way across the Pacific to Hawaii, and from Hawaii came to San Francisco, and they were here in July, and now they made their way down to Monterey and off to San Diego, where they'll spend the winter. Young men and women learning the ancient ways and embracing the new technologies. The Prime Minister of the Cook Islands has vowed that by 2020, they will be completely free of using fossil fuels. They will embrace the wind and sun, and they will really dedicate their efforts to bringing back the ancient ways for transporting goods and people among the islands. It's there to be done. It isn't like we don't want any of the new stuff. We're just going to go back to the old ways. No, it's a merger of respecting the past and embracing the present so that there's a better future. So their vacas, their sailing canoes, their voyaging canoes have solar panels, for heaven's sakes. They like to have coffee, Pete's and Starbucks too, while they're at sea, and they can do that. But at the same time, they don't need an engine to get from here to there. They don't need oil or gas to power their way across the Pacific. I met with them when they came to Hawaii. I met with them when they came to San Francisco. I saw them when they're down in Monterey, and I'm going to go to San Diego in November to meet with them again. And then I hope that I connect with them in the Galapagos when they take off in the spring as they make their way back across the Pacific with a message of hope for the ocean. That's cause for hope. I mean, it is that there are people who really do care and are using their power to make a difference. And America's Cup coming to San Francisco in 2013, 2 years from now, it's amazing that they have dedicated their event and all of the events leading up to it to the sustainability of the sea, to healthy oceans. And next week here in San Francisco, they will launch this announcement, this campaign, Healthy Oceans Campaign, using the power of a sport to celebrate the athletes who are involved, to celebrate the technologies involved, to celebrate this great race, but also to realize that we're in another kind of race that we can't afford to lose. I want to share this little video clip of the America's Cup ships out here in San Francisco Bay. I had a chance to go on one, and I kept looking for the engine. We were screaming along. I don't know what it wasn't at their top speed, but it felt faster than being in one of these high-powered motorboats going across the surface. And it was just the wind. So take a look at this. So how cool is it that America's Cup is coming to our backyard here? I say our backyard because my backyard is in Oakland. And the idea that they're going to put the spotlight on the ocean and really want to encourage youngsters to embrace sailing, to embrace the ocean, to care for the ocean. This is an opportunity to magnify the message. This is one kind of race. There's another kind of race that is not really a race, but it's called that if you look at the newspapers, about the race to the bottom with Richard Branson, with Jim Cameron, with others who are saying we've got to get to the bottom of the ocean and who wants to be first. This should be a race to see who can do it really in a way that is an effective working system or systems. We need to have the technology to explore the ocean from top to bottom. I mean, I started these few minutes of time shared with you with the image of Trieste going down to the Mariana Trench in 1960. Here it is, 2011, and still only two humans have glimpsed what it's like from their personal viewpoint. It shouldn't be necessarily a race who's going to get there next. Nobody can get there first anymore. It's been done. But to get there with a kind of system that will enable a thoughtful view to be able to stop and to look around and to take samples, take photographs, and bring back the news, not just at the bottom, but throughout the full 7-mile water column. And if you can go there, this is the key. You can go anywhere in the ocean. You're not inhibited or prohibited anymore from going to a place that is a little too deep, because you can go to the deepest place. You can go to the various trenches. You can go to the deepest place in the Gulf of Mexico. If there's a spill a mile deep, no big deal. Just take your little vehicle and go down there and take a look. Check it out. Solve the problem. Figure it out. What are we waiting for? This is the time, as never before, when we have magnified power and a magnified opportunity to leave the world a better place. Thank you.
Thank you for providing a critique of the race to the bottom, because as you probably know, the race to the poles in the late 19th and early 20th century was really empty of scientific knowledge and achievement. It was great for the press, great for the national egos, but it produced very little, right? Okay, good. Now, why yesterday, though, did you not raise the question of aquaculture? Is that to you an invasion of the great blue wild oceans that is intolerable? Or is it a solution to the depredations that have been carried on in the name of exploitation? Where do you stand on this?
Well, I think intelligent aquaculture has a great future, because just as when, after 10,000 years, we've sort of boiled down the options of mostly what we consume, it's four kinds, corn, rice, wheat, soy, supply 80% of our calories, flat out, around the world. And about 100 plants otherwise supply most of the rest, a little bit, and feed the animals that we also consume. And it's like 2% wild life, but that number has to diminish because we've just used up the ocean. And we could still have the library of life out there to choose from, just as we do on the land. There are 250,000 different kinds of flowering plants, and we have boiled it down to this many that we use as sources of food and mostly medicines and things. But you know, there's this cornucopia of life that we haven't even begun to value with a proper attitude and respect, and animals too, for what it's worth. But low on the food chain. We shouldn't be raising carnivores. What are we thinking, raising salmon, for heaven's sakes? Even when you take the best figures that the salmon farmers will say, well, they'll say, it's only 4-1. And we take 4 pounds of wild fish to get a pound of cultivated fish. Well, that should be unacceptable from the get-go, because it's a recipe that doesn't work. You take more from here to get to there. I mean, you'd soon go bankrupt if you tried to run a business that way, but the fish that are out in the ocean are free, right? You just have to go catch them. So they're not accounted for with a proper weight. Or if it's not, it's actually not 4 or 5 pounds, because you're not putting on the balance sheet how many plants did it take to make the small creatures that made the next size up that made the creatures that you feed to the salmon. If you peel it back that way, it's a much bigger figure. For a pound of chicken, it's about 2 pounds of plants. A pound of catfish or tilapia, it's about 2 pounds of plants, because they go to market in about a year, from an egg to market in about a year. With cows, it's about 20 pounds of plants to make a pound of cow. And it's, you know, less than 2 years. It's a year plus a bit. Pigs, also pretty efficient, converters of the sunlight's energy through pounds, plants to make protein. But think about a salmon, or think about a tuna. A bluefin tuna isn't 1 year old or 2 or 3. It takes 14 or so years, according to Barbara Block, to get a bluefin tuna to the point where it's able to make more bluefin tuna. And if you let them go, they might live to be 30 or so. We don't really know what the upper limit is, maybe, you know, 25 or 30. But the big old tunas that were 1,000 pounds are really rare these days. They grow pretty fast, but they eat a lot. They eat a lot. They're, you know, high energy. Water, their body temperature is above the water temperature. They're basically warm-blooded fish. And they consume a lot and they burn a lot. So if you do the numbers, and it's a rough calculation, but considering, let's say, a 10-year-old tuna, not yet mature, but 10 years old, pretty big fish, several hundred pounds perhaps, that eats other fish, and maybe other fish, and then down to the plankton, where it's, you know, within the plankton, you may have 3 or 4 levels of the food chain going on, with big plankton eating smaller plankton that eats smaller plankton that eats the plants. Or maybe it's simpler than that. You get krill that eat the plants. Or whatever it is, it's complex right at the bottom. Think in terms of thousands of pounds of plants to make 1 pound of tuna. Even a 6-year-old tuna, still thousands of pounds. Maybe it's on the order of 100,000 pounds to make a 10-year-old bluefin tuna. It's not a very efficient use of the planet's resources, if you will. It's a luxury food, no matter how you slice it. And that's true with most carnivores that are out there in the sea. Swordfish, high energy. Speed around. Takes several years for them to mature. Big investment. So cultivating carnivores should be a non-starter. And yet, oh, the effort going in for salmon. And they're trying to raise cod, or they are raising cod in Scotland and in Norway. I mean, what are we thinking? We know enough to know, after all this time, that you need to go low on the food chain. I'm a great fan of tilapia. Doesn't taste like tuna, but chicken, what does chicken taste like? It tastes like onions, or lemon, or garlic, or whatever it is you put on it. And the great thing about tilapia, it doesn't taste like much of anything until you do to it what you want it to taste like. And so when you get fish and chips, what the heck are you getting? It might be wood chips, deep fried, for all you know. It tastes, and maybe it is fish beneath all those layers of stuff. But they don't tell you what kind it is. At least you have some thought that when you get Kentucky Fried Chicken, that it's chicken. You don't get Kentucky Fried Bird. Or a cheeseburger, a hamburger, it's probably beef, probably. But you don't get a mammal burger. But you get fish and chips. You get the catch of the day, which, you know, we don't care much what it is, just so it's fish. So why not raise tilapia or catfish for the most part? If you have endless amounts of money and investment to raise sturgeon or tuna or whatever for an occasional treat and realize it's going to cost a lot. But we aren't paying the real cost when we buy farmed salmon. We aren't paying the cost to the ocean. We're not. It's this big empty part of the balance sheet that we haven't. We'll pay. I mean, we are paying, but it's not made immediately apparent to us how much we're paying. So I like closed systems. I like what they're doing out in the island school in the Bahamas, where they have like a figure eight. Here they're raising tilapia, and they're not crowding them. They're raising enough so that the fish are kind of happy. They got room to swim around, and they eat plants, and they fertilize the water, and the water goes around to a garden. And the vegetables grow over here, fertilized by what the fish do to the water, and the cleansed water then goes back to the fish. Big figure eight. Cook Island and Cook University in Australia, they're really pioneering some really cutting-edge aquaculture, closed systems like aquariums. Now we know what we didn't know 50 years ago about taking care of fish, keeping them alive, giving them what they need, and not killing them. Not, you know, one of the big problems with shrimp and the salmon farms and the other farms that are popping up here and there is they crowd them too much, they feed them more than they can eat at once, and a lot of excess food goes into the sea, and they use antibiotics, pour it on. That comes back to us too. It's just, we know how to do it right, and we've got a lot of recipes for doing it not right. We need to, you know, get out of the old way, the way that salmon farms are now managed. Just, you know, when you know it's wrong, why don't you just stop? Just stop and move in the right direction. I mean, that's what we need to do. And I don't think we need to go out in the ocean for the most part. I do see there is a place for it in places that are, like, close to shore where it's already messed up one way or the other, and maybe planting oysters or something can help clean the water at the same time you get mussels or clams or oysters. But do you really want to eat them when they've been out in the ocean? You know what you put in the ocean? All the stuff you don't want in you. I'd rather have a closed system where you can control what they eat. You know what they have in their bodies that you don't mind having in your body. Wild fish, you have no idea where they've come from, what they've been eating, or what you will then be consuming. So, great fan of aquaculture done right. Long answer, but it's a big question.
Hi, my name's Kerry Tremain. And I have a question about Dewar, but I can't resist a little ironic footnote here. And that is that these lectures are sponsored by the Hitchcock family, and they were owned a piece of property in Napa as well as in San Francisco, which is the both Napa State Park. And that park is among 70 parks that are being closed by the state of California within the next year. So even as we're hoping to expand our marine protected areas, we seem to be retreating on our ones on the land, at least here in California. I was had the privilege of seeing the ROV, the Antarctic ROV. Liz showed it to me. My favorite thing about it was that she said it was constructed out of a very well-tested technology, that being sewage pipe.
Right on.
She explained that once it was through the ice, it was capable of sending out radio signals that allowed other ROVs to come in from the side, which seemed particularly interesting.
That's right.
So my
not
question
radio,
is a very
sonar.
Simple one, which is, has it been deployed at this point or used? I couldn't tell from your talk.
This ice vehicle, they call it one of the names for it at least, is the isopod. Some of you will appreciate that. This long, slim, wonderful creature that has been developed to solve this problem of getting through a hole in the ice, limited by the ability to make a hole in the ice. The dimensions were set. Couldn't be any bigger than just so it could slide through and then come back up, but then unfold and do all these wonderful things. Well, the money came through National Science Foundation to build the vehicle, But what they didn't have the money to do, and it's been a big problem, is for the fuel to get across the ice to the ice shelf where they can deploy it. So one whole season was lost because they didn't have the resources. They got the machine, but they can't deploy it. And that's still an issue. It's like the old nursery rhyme thing, yes, my dear, you may go swimming, but don't go near the water. It's a conundrum. Yes, this thing can swim, but it can't get to the water. It can't get to the ice patch that it needs. So there have been tests planned and tests scrapped to go to Lake Tahoe. In fact, there was a test a year ago to go to the Arctic. And, you know, one thing and another, it just seems perverse. The system exists. You can go look at it and watch it run through its paces of opening up and closing and deploying the manipulators and turning on the lights and showing you this really cool camera that will probably have to be replaced because there'll be a better one in 2 months or 3 months or whatever. But, you know, one good thing is things do get better instrumentation, the longer you wait. But how much pain. My mother used to say, patience is a virtue. Acquire it if you can. It's seldom found in women, never found in man. Everybody's losing patience, not with the engineering, but with just bringing to closure enough money. You've given us the machine. You've given us the mandate. Now, help us get it there. This was supposed to be in the water last year, supposed to be in the water this year. They were hoping that by next year, maybe there'll still be some ice in Antarctica next year. If they wait long enough, you know, they can deploy this for other purposes. But come and see. I mean, it's really fascinating. And the great thing I love about this little entity, DOER Marine, is that instead of saying, here's the machine, now go use it, they say, what do you need? And we'll try to help you solve the problem. And that's the right synergy, I think, between science and technology, getting the engineers to listen to the scientists and get the scientists listen to what's possible and what's unrealistic. And there are a lot of things I could wish for that are not realistic, but you get brought down to reality when you talk to the engineers who know their stuff, and together you can hammer out something that can really make a difference. And I think this, again, it's one of the reasons I'm so glad to be alive just at this point in time, because you never know what's around the corner, what new cool thing is going to be discovered or developed, or what you can do to latch on to make one of your dreams come true.
We would like to thank Dr. Ehrlichman for her lovely lectures, and thank you for all of your insights.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.